Well, I'm going to try to synthesize some of the questions. I mean, it's also in California. I mean, in Los Angeles, it's tomorrow, the disappearance day of Srila Madhavendra Puri. And that topic will bring in some of the elements, or many of the elements of the devotees' inquiries. So this, in the progression of reading, generally the first book is the Ishopanishad, and then after the Ishopanishad is the Bhagavad Gita, then after the Bhagavad Gita is the Nectar of Devotion, the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, then say more advanced, although there, but anyway, say after that would be Srimad Bhagavatam, and then after that is Chaitanya Charitamrita. So we're going to a, you know, very advanced book. But within the discussion, we'll discuss elements of many of the questions that you asked, and also include, you know, the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the question about the material world, that is very important, because we are in the material world. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has explained that there are three topics covered by the Vedic literature, and they are sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana. And sambandha means knowledge, sambandha gyan, means knowledge of the different elements and the relationships between them. So one of the elements is the material world. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains that he has two energies, the material energy and the spiritual energy. And then he is the controller of both. So the material energy is, everything here is temporary, as Surabhi quoted. But the living entity is eternal. The spirit soul is eternal. And the spirit soul wants to be, by nature, in a permanent atmosphere. But coming in the material world, it's in an atmosphere where everything is temporary, which gives rise to fearfulness. So there are a number of verses that discuss why we become fearful and how to overcome fearfulness. But the basic answer is that if we understand that we're not the body, then, you know, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, we become we become joyful because we realize that the body, which is temporary, is not us. And the body is subjected to different miseries. Janma, mritya, jara, vyadi, birth, old age, disease, and death. But those only affect the body. They don't actually affect us, the living entity. And one loses that fear when one realizes one is not the body. So I'll read this section. It's a part of the section, you could say. Now this section involves Madhavendra Puri. Madhavendra Puri was the spiritual master of Ishwara Puri, who Lord Chaitanya accepted as his spiritual master. And Madhavendra Puri had other disciples, of course, and one of them was Ramachandra Puri. So at this stage of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Ramachandra Puri, this is after the passing away of Madhavendra Puri. And so Ramachandra Puri has come to Neelachal, Jagannath Puri, and he had a very mischievous mentality in that one of the things he would do is he would induce devotees to eat more and more and more, and then he would criticize them for eating too much. Because the Bhagavad Gita says one should not eat too much or eat too little. So, actually, once I was at a home in Durban, South Africa, with His Holiness Indradumya Swami, and the host and hostess prepared a huge feast. But the way they were serving it, you know, after a while, like each preparation they brought, they sort of gave the impression that it was the last one. And it was sort of like, you know, eat more, because, you know, it's... And then they'd bring another one, and then, you know, eat more. And, it was like so much, I didn't think I could eat more, but it was sort of considered the etiquette to eat whatever the hosts offered. So, you know, once when they left the room to bring more, I turned to Indradumya Swami and I said, Maharaj, I don't think I can eat anymore. And we don't know when it's going to end. It's just coming. So he said, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says one should not eat too much or eat too little. So today we're concentrating on not eating too little. Well, anyway, so this Ramachandra Puri, of course, they just wanted to, I don't know what their mood was, I guess to make us happy by feeding us. But Ramachandra Puri's mood was to, create a situation in which he could criticize the devotees, blaspheme the devotees. So there are many of We'll just enter at a certain point because there are many instances of Ramachandra Puri's behavior. So this, we'll just start here. This relates to Jagadananda Pandit, who is a pure devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But we should start with this, with our mantra here. Please repeat. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Antya Lila, Chapter 8, Text 1. Tam Vande Krishna Chaitanyam Ramachandra Puri Bhayat Lokika Haratasyam Bo Vikshanam Samakochayat. Let me offer my respectful obeisances to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who reduced his eating due to fear of the criticism of Ramachandra Puri. So Jagadananda Pandit, so Ramachandra Puri, he was a disciple of Madhavendra Puri. That means in generation, he was of the same generation as Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master, who was also a disciple of Madhavendra Puri. So the etiquette is that one respects the, godbrother of the spiritual master on the same level as the spiritual master. And so the devotees, including Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, were respecting Ramachandra Puri in that way. So one of Lord Chaitanya's devotees, Jagadananda Pandit, invited Ramachandra Puri for prasad. So we'll begin here, text 11. A large quantity of the remnants of food from Lord Jagannath was brought in for distribution. Ramachandra Puri ate sumptuously, and then he wanted to find faults in Jagadananda Pandit. After finishing the meal, Ramachandra Puri requested, "My dear Jagadananda, please listen. You eat the food that is left." With great eagerness, Ramachandra Puri seated Jagadananda Pandit and personally served him prasad. Encouraging him again and again, Ramachandra Puri fed him sumptuously. But when Jagadananda had washed his hands and mouth, Ramachandra Puri began criticizing him. "I have heard," he said, "that the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu eat more than necessary. Now I have directly seen that this is true. Feeding a sannyasi too much breaks his regulative principles, for when a sannyasi eats too much, his renunciation is destroyed." End quote. The characteristic of Ramachandra Puri was that first he would induce someone to eat more than necessary, and then he would criticize him. Now we come to the disappearance pastime of Madhavendra Puri. Formerly, When Madhavendra Puri was at the last stage of his life, Ramachandra Puri came to where he was staying. Madhavendra Puri was chanting the holy name of Krishna, and sometimes he would cry, "Oh my Lord, I did not get shelter at Mathura." Then Ramachandra Puri was so foolish that he fearlessly dared to instruct his spiritual master. Quote, "If you are in full transcendental bliss," he said, "you should now remember only Brahman. Why are you crying?" Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, a Brahman realized person is always happy. Nashochati Nakamshati. He neither laments nor aspires for anything. Not knowing why Madhavendra Puri was crying, Ramachandra Puri tried to become his advisor. Thus he committed a great offense, for a disciple should never try to instruct his spiritual master. Text 22. Hearing this instruction, Madhavendra Puri, greatly angry, rebuked him by saying, "Get out, you sinful rascal." Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Ramachandra Puri could not understand that his spiritual master, Madhavendra Puri, was feeling transcendental separation. His lamentation was not material. Rather, it proceeded from the highest stage of ecstatic love of Krishna. When he was crying in separation, quote, "I could not achieve Krishna, I could not reach Mathura," end quote. This was not ordinary material lamentation. Ramachandra Puri was not sufficiently expert to understand the feelings of Madhavendra Puri, but nevertheless he thought himself very advanced. Therefore, regarding Madhavendra Puri's expressions as ordinary material lamentation, he advised him to remember Brahman, because Ramachandra Puri, was latently an impersonalist. Madhavendra Puri understood Ramachandra Puri's position as a great fool, and therefore immediately rebuked him. Such a reprimand from the spiritual master is certainly for the betterment of the disciple. So there are many elements here, but the most important is that, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, the material world is an inverted reflection of the spiritual world. The Bhagavad Gita gives the example of a banyan tree that's roots are upwards and branches are downwards. And the example is given that if you see the reflection of a tree on the bank of a body of water, so when you look at the reflection, the roots will be at the top, and the top of the tree will be at the bottom. So everything that exists in the original exists in the reflection. So everything that exists in the spiritual world also exists in the material world. But everything in the material world is upside down. In the material world, in material consciousness, everyone wants to be the master of the master of the master. Whereas in the spiritual world, everyone wants to be the servant of the servant of the servant. So just as we have desire in the material world, there's also desire in the spiritual world. But in the material world, or in material consciousness, the desire is for our own happiness. And because material consciousness means we identify with the body, so we think that that happiness means sense gratification of the senses of the body, or the mind, which is the center of the senses. And in the spiritual world, everyone desires Krishna's happiness. And so that's called prema, that's pure love, and what we have in the material world is kama, or lust. And the two can resemble each other, but there's a world of difference between them. So, in the material world, someone may be attached to something for his or her sense gratification, and then when he's separated from the object of attachment, he becomes sad. He laments. But the same phenomena exists in the spiritual world. But in the material world, the attachment and the lamentation bring misery. Whereas in the spiritual world, the attachment and lamentation are ecstasy. So, Madhavendra Puri was on a very high level, and he wanted to be with Krishna in Mathura to serve him for Krishna's happiness. And it's sort of an even more advanced stage that one feels, unqualified, humble. The sign of advancement is that one's humble, and humble means that one feels that one is unqualified. So Madhavendra Puri was feeling, I want to serve Krishna, and I'm not able to reach him because I'm so lowly and fallen. And Ramachandra Puri, he couldn't understand, because he was, underneath it all, he was an impersonalist. And frankly, most people, unless or until they get the association of pure devotees, they are impersonalists. And that they think that, the ultimate is in something impersonal, and that the goal is to merge and become one with it. And that all varieties are material, maya. And so they think, desire is maya. So they try to stop desire, which they can't do, but they try. That's the theory, that to stop desire. And anger, it's the same thing in the material world. If you want something and then you don't get it, you become angry. Or if you have something and you think someone is the cause of your losing it, you become angry, can become angry. So, spiritually, one wants to serve Krishna and give Krishna pleasure. And if someone interferes with Krishna's pleasure, the pure devotee can become angry. Not because of a personal frustration, like in material consciousness, but because of his desire to make Krishna happy. And that anger can be used to remove the impediment to Krishna's happiness. So that happened here, that when Ramchandra Puri was, giving bad advice to his spiritual master, so his spiritual master became angry. Krodha Upajjaya, that anger arose within him and he rebuked him. So, we'll continue, text 23. O my Lord Krishna, I could not reach you, nor could I reach your abode, Mathura. I'm dying in my unhappiness, and now this rascal has come to give me more pain. But again, that unhappiness, that's like externally, it's unhappiness. Internally, it's spiritual bliss. He says, don't show your face to me. Go anywhere else you like. If I die seeing your face, I shall not achieve the destination of my life. I'm dying without achieving the shelter of Krishna, and therefore I'm greatly unhappy. Now this condemned foolish rascal has come to instruct me about Brahman. Ramachandra Puri was thus denounced by Madhavendra Puri. Due to his offense, gradually material desire appeared within him. So this is a very important point in that there are consequences if we commit offenses, and the scriptures mention particularly 10 offenses against the holy name, and one of them first is sadhu ninda. To criticize devotees, blaspheme devotees. Another is guru avagya, to disrespect the spiritual master or disobey the instructions of the spiritual master. So Ramachandra Puri was committing these offenses, and as a result, material desires appeared within him. Sometimes it happens that a person will come to the association of devotees and be very enthusiastic about Krishna consciousness. And I remember my own experience, and I also discussed with other devotees who had joined, and they also felt the same way, that like to them everyone seemed like a pure devotee when they joined. And so the mood was very surcharged with spiritual energy. But then what can happen is by becoming too familiar with devotees, You can start to see, I thought this person was such a great devotee, but I saw this, I saw that, and then you start to commit offenses, and the result of the offenses, one of the results is that material desires develop. Another effect, Srila Jiva Goswami enumerates the different effects of offenses. One is that you become attracted to the association of people who are offensive. You're drawn to their company. And another result, and it goes with that, is that you commit more offenses. So it's a real downward spiral. And Ramachandra Puri, he became implicated in offenses. And one of the material desires is the desire to merge and become one with Brahman. It's also considered a material desire. Text 27. One who is attached to dry speculative knowledge has no relationship with Krishna. His occupation is criticizing Vaishnavas. Thus, he is situated in criticism. So this is one example, Ramachandrapur. So now we come to the example of Ishwarapuri. Ishwarapuri, the spiritual master of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, performed service to Madhavendrapuri, cleaning up his stool and urine with his own hand. Ishwarapuri was always chanting the holy name and pastimes of Lord Krishna for Madhavendrapuri to hear. In this way, he helped Madhavendrapuri remember the holy name and pastimes of Lord Krishna at the time of death. So when we serve someone, in general, and in particular at the time of death, we want to serve them, you know, serve their bodies, like in this case is cleaning up his stool and urine with his own hand. And also we want to serve the soul by helping the person by enchanting and hearing about Krishna and remembering Krishna. And this is especially true at the time of death, because the time of death is considered the final exam. There's a verse that, you know, whatever sadhana and bhajan you do during your life will be tested at the time of death. And if you can remember Krishna at the time of death, then you go to Krishna. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam, whatever is your state of mind at the time of death will determine your next birth. Pleased with Ishwarapuri, Madhavendrapuri embraced him and gave him the benediction that he would become a great devotee and lover of Krishna. Thus, Ishwarapuri became like an ocean of ecstatic love for Krishna, whereas Ramachandrapuri became a dry speculator and a critic of everyone else. Ishwarapuri received the blessing of Madhavendrapuri, whereas Ramachandrapuri received a rebuke from him. Therefore, these two persons, Ishwarapuri and Ramachandrapuri, are examples of the objects of a great personality's benediction and punishment. Madhavendrapuri instructed the entire world by presenting these two examples. Now, in my biological father, was diagnosed with cancer. And so eventually things came to the point where I came to be with him. He was in a hospital in a suburb of Chicago. And the, you know, the idea within our family was that someone should always be with him from the family. And, you know, at the time my sister had a son who was 4.5 years old, so she had to take care of him and then at the same time look after my mother. So at night it was decided that I should logically be the one to stay with him in the hospital room. So his condition was such there was, I guess, like a sofa in the hospital room. I at night I would lie down on the sofa. But yeah, my father's condition was such that he needed help to get out of the bed. And then, you know, there was some distance from the bed to the bathroom. And he would every so often have to go to the bathroom. So I was in a constant state of alert, vigilance, because at any moment he might need my help to get out of bed and go to the bathroom. And plus the whole situation of his illness, and which did, you know, I mean, everyone had their hopes, but it definitely looked like he could be heading towards the end. So the whole situation was emotionally stressful. So I could hardly sleep. You know, I was like constantly listening if there's some sound that indicated that he needed help. But sometimes I was just like so exhausted I would doze off. But then very soon there would be a sound. And I didn't know what it was, and very often it was my father. So, you know, I would help him, and I'd get up, help him out of bed, and walk him to the bathroom. And sometimes he didn't make it in time. So there was mess, and I, you know, dealt with the mess. And so this went on, and it was like very, very exhausting. And then at about, I think the sun was just rising, it was just starting to come, be visible through the window shades of the hospital room. And, you know, he sort of like called me close and he said, you know, what would you do if I gave you $1 million? And, you know, I don't even know what I answered, because that was not on my mind at all. You know, I wanted to try to, make his situation as easy as possible for him. And, it was my duty, and also out of love. I didn't want him to suffer. So he said, what would you do if I gave you $1 million? And I don't even know what I said or if I said anything. But, and then, you know, morning came and his illness took its course and eventually he left. So it just so happened that the day before my father ended up leaving, eventually we brought him home and he left his body at home. His Holiness Radhana Swami was visiting his father in Chicago. And it was arranged that he was going to come up to see me on Monday. And on Sunday, in the evening, the nurse who was there, was like a, you know, rotation of nurses that were attending to my father at home. She saw signs that indicated he was going to be leaving. So not just that, but he was calling for everyone. She must have seen something, because he wasn't really able to move much at all, but he, maybe through his eyes or some gesture, she said, you know, she came to everyone in the house and said, you know, he's going to be leaving now and he's calling for everyone. So I quickly phoned Radha Naswami and I said, you know, my father's leaving now. Probably said, please pray for him. And I don't think it's going to work for us to get together tomorrow. We're going to need some time. And he left, you know, and it was at the very end, like his eyes opened wide and he left. And there's like this big smile on his face. And my sister, who was a sort of like, you know, sort of rational, scientific type, you know. I mean, she just couldn't, she said, well, I mean, it was just so obvious being with him, just the way he opened his eyes and ended up with this smile. She said, what do you think he saw that made him smile, you know, it's like... But anyway, of course, then lamentation came. And so, you know, a few days later, His Holiness Radhanathaswami came up to visit. And so I told him this story of when my father was in the hospital. And he said that it was very similar to Ishvara Puri serving Madhavendra Puri. That like he gave his full energy, you know, to serving his spiritual master, and in the end, his spiritual master was so pleased with him that he gave him, you know, the greatest treasure of love of God, Prema Dhan. He said the same thing happened with your father, except. He didn't really have a spiritual treasure, he had like a material treasure, but still he had that mood of wanting to like give his, you know, bestow his treasure on you. So we return to this pastime, but it is a very special time when the soul is leaving the body. It's not always easy for the soul to leave the body, but it creates a very sacred space. In Santa Barbara, where I have a base now, there is the situation has changed a lot, but there was a rabbi who came to the to be the rabbi of the temple that my sister and other family members are members of, and there's like so much to say. Anyway, when my mother passed away, there was a little ceremony at the family's house in Santa Barbara. And so he came. And just, you know, maybe just a little after he came, I gave a talk. And in the talk, you know, I said many things about my mother, but I also mentioned about the soul leaving the body and the soul being eternal. And, you know, basically some elements of the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita. So he was just coming in as the new rabbi, and, you know, there was an interim rabbi. And so he, so there was an event sort of like to appreciate the interim rabbi who was leaving, who was very charismatic. And so it was like an odd thing, like, so the new rabbi was there, but everyone was like paying a lot of attention to the interim rabbi who was leaving. And so, I sort of went close to him, and he said, "I heard your talk, you know, at your mother's memorial service, and I was very impressed by what you said." And I said, "You know, well, it was like," and he said, "Like, where did that all come from?" So I said, "You know, part of it was just like from my heart, you know, my realization. But I've also studied." I said, "You know, I had a teacher from India, and I studied the Bhagavad Gita with him, and a lot of what I said is in the Bhagavad Gita." And yeah, he was like really, so I was like quite touched by what I had said, and quite moved by it. So we became sort of friends, and you know, I'd occasionally meet him, and he was saying that it was a little hard for him, because he had been the rabbi of a smaller congregation where, in a way, there was more, you know, more study, more prayer. And in this larger congregation, he felt, you know, he felt his, some of his energy was being drained. So I said, "Well, is there anything that gives you energy?" And I said, "You know, maybe focus on those things." Because all of us, whatever our position is, whatever our work is, some things drain our energy and some things give us energy. So I said, are there any things that give you energy? You know, what gives you energy? You know, he mentioned maybe one or two things, but what I really remember, he said, this might come as a surprise to you, but when I visit a congregant who's at the end of life and is about to pass away, and then I minister to that person, I get energy. And I could relate to that, because it's a very surcharged situation. Although it can be a terrible situation if the person identifies with the body and, you know, has been very sinful, and, you know, I mean, it can be terrifying. But I guess when a rabbi is going, they have some faith, and they have some hope that, you know, they'll be maybe transported to a better place or something like that. So this is a very important time. It's like the final exam, you know. So it's so to help someone pass the final exam of their life is really the best service that you can do. Now, of course, sometimes it happens that a person will pass away without notice, without much notice, like in an accident. You know, it could be an automobile accident, it could be a fire, it could be some sort of like asthmatic attack or something that comes with very little warning, and it could be within, you know, minutes. So at that time, we depend on our spiritual efforts up until then, and the mercy that that will come to us, in you could say reciprocation for our spiritual efforts. Srila Prabhupada had a disciple named Tamal Krishna Goswami, one of his most prominent disciples. And at one stage, Tamal Krishna Goswami asked him that, you know, I'm so absorbed in serving you. What if I'm serving you and death comes? You know, I'm not like chanting or specifically remembering Krishna, but I'm just serving you. And Srila Prabhupada said that, you know, don't worry, Lord Chaitanya will like forcibly enter your mind and make you think of him. But of course that's our hope, and of course to the degree that we really surrender to the Lord's service and give ourselves to the Lord's service, that we'll be likely to get that special mercy. And there are so many stories of devotees who've left their bodies who've gotten special mercy. I mean, just even devotees who may have had some difficulties along the way, but at the end, because of their sincere service, they get special mercy. And of course, I've seen many cases of Prabhupada's disciples, but even grand disciples of Srila Prabhupada, disciples of his disciples, have received very special mercy at the end. So, I'll just read a little bit more, a few more verses. Text 33. His divine grace, Madhavendra Puri, the spiritual master of the entire world, thus distributed ecstatic love for Krishna. While passing away from the material world, he chanted the following verse. I'll read the verse. Text 34. Ayi dina dayadra natha hai mathura natha kadava lok yase hridayam twad aloka kataram dayita brahmyati kim karom yaham. O my Lord, O most merciful Master, O Master of Mathura, when shall I see you again? Because of my not seeing you, my agitated heart has become unsteady. O most beloved one, what shall I do now? Text 35. In this verse, Madhavendra Puri teaches how to achieve ecstatic love for Krishna. By feeling separation from Krishna, one becomes spiritually situated. So this verse is a very special verse, and it really represents the mood of Radharani and separation from Krishna. And it was said that there were only three people who could really understand the significance of the verse. One was Srimati Radharani, one was Madhavendra Puri, and one was Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Like, no fourth person could really fathom the depths of that verse in the mood of separation. Ecstatic love and separation. And by such feelings of separation, one becomes spiritually situated. And we also have something similar even on the material platform. When someone passes away, you know, the people at the crematorium, they feel detached from the material world. I remember once a very wealthy man, Sri Chand Hinduja, his son, only son, and he passed away in a very tragic way. And there was a cremation near Juhu. The Hindujas have a huge mansion, and it's like a hotel on Juhu Beach. And so, you know, many of the most affluent people came, and many Sindhis, there were Sindhis. And so one of them, who I knew, you know, very well, he came up to me sort of towards the end of the ceremony. He was saying, you know, you see this happen and then you wonder, like, what's it all for? You know, we work so hard to make money and build up our empires, and then it ends like this. So what's the use? What's it all for? So there's a Sanskrit word for that called smashan vairagya, the detachment at the crematorium. It arises in someone's heart at that moment, seeing the body go up in flames, but it doesn't last. And the same person, you know, a week later or a month later, was like, you know, doing business like crazy, and, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with it, but so this is smashan vairagya, the detachment at the crematorium. But the idea is that separation gives rise to detachment. I had a very small experience on the island of St. Lucia. Krishna Kirtan came there with me once. So, you know, so we were staying with this family, they originally from Bombay, actually, and they had a beautiful home, and they gave me a whole area to myself, and they had like such a nice service mood, like they didn't want any attention or anything, you know, they just wanted me to have whatever facility I needed for my service. And, you know, wife was a great cook, and then the husband was an eye doctor, so like when he would come back, he'd take us out, we'd go like go for a walk by the seaside, and it was just ideal. And during that time, you know, I was chanting like 32 rounds a day and reading. I mean, it was just ideal. But you know, when we'd go out in the car, you know, to go for a walk or something, it's sort of inevitable that there's billboards, you look at the billboards, there's shops, there's people, you sort of. I mean, I knew it wasn't really that good, but it was sort of hard to control. But on the last day, like when I was leaving, so like I was feeling separation, you know, I was leaving and, you know, separation from the family and also just from that experience that I had, like so much chanting and reading and just so nice in every respect. And so in that sort of mood of separation, I didn't care to look at the billboards, I didn't care to look at the different shops and people. It was, you know, it was like in a different space, you know, in a different mood. So this feeling of separation is very important in Krishna consciousness, very much in our line. Madhavendra Puri, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Six Goswamis, they all have that mood. And you can only have that when there's some attachment. You know, if you... when you get attached from something, then you can feel separated. Separation from it. If there's no attachment, you won't feel separation. You know, there's... every day there's... I'm just making it up. It's whatever. So many millions of people die every day. We don't feel any separation from them because we don't know them. We have no attachment for them. But if you have attachment for someone, then you feel separation. And so having feelings of separation for Krishna and devotees of Krishna, that's good separation. That will be an impetus to our increasing our Krishna consciousness. In this verse, Madhavendra Puri teaches how to achieve ecstatic love for Krishna. By feeling separation from Krishna, one becomes spiritually situated. Madhavendra Puri sowed the seed of ecstatic love for Krishna within this material world and then departed. That seed later became a great tree in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Thus I have described the passing away of Madhavendra Puri. Anyone who hears this must be considered very fortunate, but a Bhagyavan. That's all of us, all of you. So that's basically the end of that pastime. I mean, there's more, but yeah. So I think we should stop here. I mean, there were so many other things, and I did want to answer that question about the dairy industry. But I think we'll sort of continue in this line, and then and maybe we'll have a part two. Because this... yeah, but even if we can't have a big presentation, we can meet afterwards because it's a big topic that Purushottam Kshetra Prabhu and I have been discussing a lot just these last 2 days, and he's gone very deep in the subject. All right, so
Ask anyone his questions, Mark?
Okay.
Does anyone have any questions for
Mark? On the subject that we've discussed. Just
the verse you quoted on Yam Yam Bhapi Smaran Bhavan, that whatever we remember at the time of death, that will determine our next life. The general process of a devotee is to remember Krishna throughout his life so that he prepares himself at that final moment.
Mm-hmm.
But what in case a karmi, for example, somehow performing his materialistic activities throughout his life, but at the final moment he remembers Krishna. Is that kind of going against the system or the kind of mainstream system of remembering or the process of actually going back to the spiritual world?
Well, generally, at the time of death, we'll think of what we're most attached to. And, you know, and so our, in our preparation for the time of death, we really should be increasing our attachment to Krishna. Like he says in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya Sapta Manaha Partha Yoga Yunjan Madashaya. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example that a parrot may learn to chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But when a cat comes and attacks the parrot, there's no more Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. It's ka, 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 ka. So Srila Prabhupada said our chanting shouldn't be like that, like a parrot, and then at the time of death, you know, we forget all the chanting, it's just ha. So, yes. Now, what you described, that an ordinary materialistic person thinks of Krishna at the time of death, is not very usual. Because, again, generally you'll think about what you're most attached to at the time of death. Now, and I'm going to tell a story about Vaikunthanath, who I actually never, I didn't hear, I don't think I heard it from him, but it, maybe I'll confirm it with him sometime. But I know he was in an accident. And what I heard was that, you know, he was driving his vehicle and it stalled on the railway tracks. And you know how it is. You want to get the car started. So he was, like, fiddling, trying to get the car started. And he saw in the distance there was a train coming. But so he thought, you know, let me get it going so I can pull the car off the tracks. And, you know, he got absorbed, but then he looked up again, and he saw the train was just about to hit the car. And he thought, this is it. You know, this is the end. So he started to chant Hare Krishna. And then, when the train actually hit, like at the last moment, he thought, what's going to happen to my wife? And then he became unconscious. So, of course, fortunately, he lived to tell the story. But the idea is that generally we think of what we're most attached to at the time of death. But then again, the mind is also so flickering, you know. But definitely, you know, in his case, he's a very sincere devotee. He lived, and I'm sure that his future will be very bright. But still, if someone is open, even though they've been sinful, if someone's open to hearing the holy name, and it happens even with parents of devotees, they themselves weren't really devotees, but somehow they have devotees around them at the time of death, chanting or so. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada gives the example of like an honorary degree. Like sometimes it happens that a university will award someone an honorary degree. But it's very rare. You know, if you think, well, I'm not going to go to the university, but, you know, I'll just get an honorary degree. Well, that's how many get an honorary degree? Very few. So the usual method, as you said, is you go to the university, you study, you write your papers, you take your exams, and you get your degree. But it is possible that you know, one can get some special mercy. But that's usually on account of some service. But yeah, we want to help give everyone the chance to remember Krishna at the time of death, or remember God and their tradition at the time of death. Like in my book, Life's Final Exam, I told the story of both my father and my mother's passing. And like there are some devotees who feel that they have to get their parents to chant Hare Krishna, or hear Hare Krishna, even if the parent is like a faithful follower of some other tradition, say Catholic tradition or any other tradition. And so generally it'll be more natural and more successful to encourage the person to remember God according to the person's tradition. Like with my mother, there was praying, but it was like within her tradition. It was also like really nice that, but anyway, there were devotees who doing kirtan for her somewhere else. And in her room, there was prayers in her tradition. So, but I remember when that time after my father passed away and His Holiness Raghunath Swami came, I asked, we were like discussing what is his destination. And, he said it's very hard to say, but there's a range of destinations one could achieve. But definitely, like Srila Prabhupada said, that the parents of his disciples will realize their good fortune at the time of their passing away. So I've seen, it was like quite clear in my parents passing away. But exactly what that means, we discussed it, Radha Swami said, it's hard to say exactly, like if he went back to Godhead or if he's going to take birth in a devotee family. He said, personally, he always likes to imagine them getting the maximum mercy. Because to chant the name of Krishna at the time of death, even if one's a materialistic person, he has to have had some association with devotees, otherwise. So it is possible that even a little association, even though the person didn't take real advantage of it, it could bear fruit at the end. But usually it takes more than that. That's why the Bhagavad Gita says that. Something like take birth again and then continue until you're completely successful. Any other questions?
If a person is leaving his body and he's not of our tradition, then it's better to not force him or her to chant Krishna's name, but to just remember God as his understanding. But what if the person is atheistic and he doesn't have image of God? Then what is the right way to make him remember something that will be beneficial to him or her?
Well, Usually there's a period before the soul leaves the body. It's where the person is not outwardly conscious. It's called like the actively dying stage. Seems like an odd term, actively dying. But what it is, it's like if you're shutting down your home, you know, you close the windows, you lock the doors, you turn off the lights. So it's like you're actively shutting down your home. So there's a stage called the active dying stage where your senses are shutting down. But this last sense to shut down is the sense of hearing. And so even if a person isn't able to express what he or she is thinking or feeling just because the senses have been shutting down, but they can hear. And it's also very important to keep that in mind, that, you know, like, that even though you might think the person is unconscious or in coma, but the person can still hear. So, I mean, obviously, in any case, you don't want to speak nonsense in the room, but so even if the person is atheist or agnostic, there can still be chanting. And you know, that living entity within the body can get the benefit of it. It's like, yeah, it's mercy. Any other questions or comments?
One question. You were mentioning how Ramachandra, he was going on a spiral downward, and Krishna also says that, you know, someone's envious, you know, he's casting them further and further away. So I was wondering then, in such an environment, so what is the saving grace? I mean, they are moving so farther away from the spiritual life. And if Krishna himself, in this case, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also is rejecting them, then the Guru is rejecting them. How does that person then come back?
Well, it's said that by suffering these reactions, a person should eventually become humble, and then when they become humble, they can, you know, seek the mercy of some Vaishnava, and then they can get reinstated.
So can a Vaishnava intervene without that person even requesting? In a sense of that, if I am, let's say, I am envious, I'm behaving bad as a, I'm committing a Vaishnava aparadha, and then Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu feels compassion towards me and he's praying on my behalf. Would that somehow help to come out, or does the person have to really go through the bottom to?
No, the prayers can help, but eventually, you know, there will have to be a change of consciousness in the person.
Trying to understand, can a change in consciousness arrive in a person by his own endeavor, or is that the Lord has to empower the person to have it?
So the Lord is the well-wisher of every living entity, so he will try to help every soul to come back to him. But, the Lord is a person, and he also has feelings. I mean, no mundane feelings, but he has spiritual feelings. And so it's said that when the Lord punishes an offender, it's for the benefit of the offender so that he doesn't commit more offenses. And it's also for the benefit of the offender if the offender becomes humbled by the experience and, you know, realizes his mistake and tries to rectify. You know, what you're talking about is something like Kripa Siddhi, which it's like the honorary degree. It's possible, but it's very rare. And generally we can't just hope. Okay, I'm just going to go around offending devotees, and then, you know, some great soul is going to be merciful. And no, we have to follow the process. Yeah. But usually it's because of a connection with a devotee. There are many offenders. Like one example, and it's sort of related to prasad, that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya invited Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to take prasad at his home. And he had a son-in-law named Amoga, who was sort of agnostic and fault finder. So he prepared like all this prasad, and you know, Lord Chaitanya, he said, you know, I'll just take a little. I'm a sannyasi, and you know, I should eat very frugally and simply. So then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, but you know, we know who you are. You know, you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're Lord Jagannath. You eat 54 huge offerings every day. This is nothing for you. And when you were, when you took the form of Govardhan Hill, you were eating mountains of prasad. And he gave like all these examples. And he said, this is nothing for you. So please, you know, don't try to fool me. We know who you are. So out of his love and his arguments, Krishna conscious arguments, so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began to honor prasad. But Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya knew the mentality of his son-in-law, so he was sort of guarding the door. But I forget what happened, maybe towards the end of the meal. Anyway, he left his post at the door, and Amoga came in, and he saw like this huge feast, and he began blaspheming. You know, you're a sannyasi, what kind of a sannyasi are you? You're eating like enough for 100 people. And then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya became like livid, you know, came with a stick and he was chasing him and sort of like cursed him. Because his daughter's name was Sati. I think may Sati become a widow. Means he was like cursing them. And everyone was in the mood. She was ready to become a widow. She didn't want to be married to him. And so then, within 3 days, Amoga got cholera, and he was like on his deathbed. And so Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya quoted a verse that it's from the Mahabharata, that when I think the Yakshas came and attacked the Kauravas, and so the maybe Yudhisthira, one of the Pandavas, said, like, you know, what we would have had to do with so many soldiers and weapons, you know, has been happened automatically, you know, without our making any endeavor. So that when they heard that he had cholera and he was about to die, so he thought like that, okay, we, you know. But then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Amoga and he put his hand on Amoga's heart And he said, you know, how have you allowed envy to sit in your heart? You know, envy should not be in the heart of a Brahmin. And you know, so he basically he cured Amoga of the cholera. But more than that, he purified his consciousness. And then Amoga, you know, fell at the feet of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I'm an offender, you know. Please forgive me. But Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was upset. He said to Chaitanya, why did you save him? You know? Maybe that was when he quoted that verse. And, you know, he said, you know, he's related to you. And because he's related to you, I wanted to purify him and save his life. Because, you know, so there are many cases. I mean, there are so many offenders, I mean. And some of them have a change of heart. And often the change of heart comes from the association of a devotee. Sometimes it comes from suffering. But sometimes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would also deliver an offender because of the offender's connection with the devotee, like Amoga, his connection with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya.
Probably it's a silly question, Maharaj. I've been thinking about it. So it seems like, so there is, we chant, but still there is a lot of opportunity for one to become a Vaishnavapara and even while chanting. But it seems like the association of devotees seems to be the cure. It's like, you know, like you were saying, that no matter what aparad someone committing, but the presence of a Vaishnava or the compassion or somehow forcing the Lord to reject his own thing, saying that I will discard, but he is going against and helping someone. So I was wondering that it seems like the association seems more powerful than chanting in helping eventually to get to the point of chanting. It seems, is that correct?
Well, the best is both. In fact, that was one of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's regular instructions to the devotees from Kalinagram. Every year they would come to Jagannath Puri and they would say, what is our duty? We're householders, what is our duty? And every year Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would say, serve the devotees and chant the holy name. So we want all the help we can get. Why should we? Okay, so, you know, if Radha Priya doesn't want to speak, she doesn't have to. I think we could. Do you think you could give like a 3-minute explanation of how to become a millionaire dairy farmer in 7 years?
Sure. So
it might have sounded funny, but there's a person who he's developed this program. Mm-hmm. It's not his.
The individual Maharaj is referring to is a. He works for the state of Iowa as a agricultural specialist in the dairy industry. And his particular interest is in helping people that want to take up a more humane kind of dairying process. In fact, he's recognized that there are a lot of young people, couples, that come from rural environments that were living on dairy farms, and they saw their parents working like slaves with thousands of cows, and they were business people, and they, you know, their whole mentality was, how can I make another buck out of this process that I'm putting these cows through? And, you know, they're just suffering tremendously. Everybody's suffering. Kids are suffering, the parents are suffering, the cows are suffering. It's hellish. So he noticed that even if you can just move the situation from thousands of cows to a few hundred cows and put them on an organic program, that already everybody's doing better than they were. So he said, all right, I wonder if that it's possible to take these young people that they're saying, you know, I don't want to live this kind of life that my parents are living, but it's the only thing I know how to do. What am I to do? So he says to them, well, I can show you how to go from the life that your parents are leading to a life where you can be happy. And by simply, instead of having thousands of cows that you feed with trucks and artificial, you know, food and supplements and hormones and all this horrible stuff that they do nowadays with cows, just have a wonderful pasture, turn them out to pasture, and the cows can take care of themselves all day long, and you can with a few hundred cows, it's very easy to take care of them relative to thousands of cows. So they give wonderful milk, and the farmer is peaceful and he has a happy family, and it's an entirely different situation. So then, with that kind of program, this fellow has worked out a way that they can practically go from virtually no investment to being millionaires in 7 years, based simply on this process that he's worked out for them. So, you know, then the question becomes, well, this sounds nice, you know, it certainly is nice, but the problem, of course, is that, you know, they don't know what to do with the progeny. These cows are going to have more cows, and half of those cows are going to be male cows. What do we do with that? And so they don't understand that too is a problem. It's a terrible problem, you know, and the way they deal with it is really unfortunate, you know, for everybody involved. And they don't also understand that, okay, at some point, what do we do with the situation where, well, the cow's not giving so much milk anymore, you know, the cow's getting older and, you know, just circumstances change. So, you know, eventually they decide, well, we have to get rid of the cow. So even the female cows, at some point, they don't work out so well. So, you know, we can offer a positive alternative at that point to these people that are thinking, okay, organic dairying is better. We can offer an even better opportunity. You know, these people, they're still reliant on petroleum, ultimately. You know, they have to transport the milk, they have to process the milk, they have to, you know, distribute the milk, they have to do all these things that, and then they have to, you know, run the tractors to, you know, make the pasture, and harvest the you know, and so it turns into this whole petroleum-based profit motive, and that's a disaster too. So the solution lies within the problem. Just put the oxen to work instead of, you know, killing them. And automatically, now, you've got the power you need to run the farm nicely, and you have a small farm that's, you know, the locals can come and take advantage of the milk products that are produced, so that you no longer have the long-distance transportation and all the you know, horrible things that go with all this use of petroleum. You can use the cow dung and the urine, because the cows are out there on the field automatically fertilizing it instead of using you know, petroleum products to fertilize, and you know, increasing the disaster. So at some point, then it just becomes a question of, well, is this economically viable? And even though there's very few present-day examples of its being economically viable, it was economically viable for the whole history of human existence. It worked. And it was only the last maybe 150 years when people, you know, decided, okay, you know, we're going to pump out petroleum from the ground and, you know, burn it in tractors and create a whole economy based on that sort of a behavior, instead of just putting the oxen to work and letting the cows do their thing and, you know, take care of them nicely in the field. And, you know, it's a whole ecologically sustainable situation at that point. And, you know, the interest is not purely to make a buck and, you know, exploit the cows. So there's another way to do it. And we just need to get from here to there. We've been there for most of human history. It's just a question of finding out how to get back there, because in due course of time, we won't have the petroleum anymore. Even the experts, they argue about, well, is it 50 years or 300 years? But nobody says we'll always have petroleum. And the problem there is that, okay, you run out of petroleum, but what you need to be able to practically do farming is serious power in the field that's relatively lightweight and compact. Well, diesel fits that bill, but so do oxen. So, you know, when there's no more diesel, they're going to be using oxen. They even work better than horses, because horses are really expensive in terms of the feed that they need to eat and the care that they need to have. Oxen, they'll eat the stubble from the harvest and be totally healthy and happy. And the horses, they're not like that. So even the horses don't work out for you. But Krishna's arranged it, but the system works nicely if you take advantage of everything that a cow can offer. So we just need to find out how to get back there.
And they can have more plantings, because during the rainy season, the tractors can't plow, but right, the oxen can.
Exactly. So you can have more harvest, because instead of only getting two plantings in a year, and so in a certain type of a climate where you get, naturally you're going to get rain. And if you're using a tractor, that tractor is going to bog down in the mud, And the oxen are happy to go out in the rain work if that's what you ask them to do. They'll go out there and plow in the rain and it works just fine. So in anyone planting, it may be smaller harvest, but when you get more plantings in a year, you're going to actually get more harvest. So it works out better.
One question.
Yes.
And these eco-villages where they're doing something like that, they're completely self-sustainable, do they take care of their cows and their calves throughout their entire life?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. To the very end?
That's the goal. And there are some villages that are achieving that goal.
They don't go to bill crates or milking days are over.
No. Yeah. As I say, you know, we're learning how to do this all over again. We don't have any 150-year-old people to tell us this is how you do this. So it's like, you know, we're having to reinvent the wheel. And that's not an easy thing to do in agriculture. You know, nobody has the knowledge. They encountered a problem like this in Cuba. In fact, I don't know if you know, there was a when the Soviet bloc broke up in the late 80s, all of a sudden they went from an economy that was based on trading tobacco and sugarcane for petroleum, tractors, and food with Soviet countries. And all of a sudden, like literally almost overnight, that exchange disappeared. And they were in desperate straits to figure out what's to be done about this. So Raul, Fidel's brother, said, "We're not going to kill the cow because we're going to get oxen and we're going to put them to work and we're going to grow our own food." So they learned how to do it all over again. And their people that worked on these vast plantations and the owners of the plantations, they started to realize that, hey, there's a lot of benefits to this. Works really nicely. It's an austere life, but it's a healthy, clean, satisfying life. And it's, they even realize that there's spiritual benefits for them to do it like this. Yeah.
I'm sure there are also villages in India that have still the old way of doing things where machinery is not that available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they could learn from that.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's one of the things they do that's really interesting in India is rather than any one farmer keeping his oxen and working his field, and then, you know, there's times when you don't need all that power, they have people that it's kind of like their service to keep oxen, like these days people keep trucking companies, so they can go from place to place and hire out their oxen in exchange for agricultural goods. So it's the same thing, but it's with a nice way of doing it.